this is Danette Gorman from HelpSyriasKids.org. We are connecting the Hudson community with a Syrian refugee camp in Ketermaya, Lebanon. You're listening to WGXC ACRA.
Oh, honey, I just heard some terrible news.
What's that, honey?
The radio station WGXC is going off the air.
Oh, my goodness. Did you know you could donate by check? Give them a check to WGXC 5662 Route 23, Accra, New York, 12405.
And you can also go to their website, wavefarm.org or wgxc.org, and donate monthly, a sustaining supporter.
Oh, I'll be a sustaining supporter, honey, once we get up to that St. Charles Hotel.
Oh, yes, I love the bar there.
There's no bar there.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you are listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, and the show is called Good Night, Norman, on WGXC 90.7. FM, Radio for Open Ears, coming to you from Hudson, New York, WGXC.org. Tonight, Norman's going to read something by Lydia Davis from the Collected Stories of Lydia Davis, which came out sometime in the noughts, 09 to be exact, the lovely paperback from Picador. The first story is called The Professor by Lydia Davis. A few years ago, I used to tell myself I wanted to marry a cowboy. Why shouldn't I say this to myself, living alone, excited by the brown landscape, sometimes noticing a cowboy in a pickup truck in my rearview mirror as I drove on the broad highways of the West Coast. In fact, I realized I would still like to marry a cowboy, though by now I'm living in the East and married already to someone who is not a cowboy. But what would a cowboy want with a woman like me, an English professor, the daughter of another English professor, not very easygoing? If I have a drink or two, I'm more easygoing, but I still speak correctly and don't know how to joke with people unless I know them well, and often these are university people or the people they live with who also speak correctly. Although I don't mind them, I feel cut off from all the other people in this country, to mention only this country. I told myself I liked the way cowboys dressed, starting with the hat and how comfortable they were in their clothes, so practical having to do with their work. Many professors seem to dress the way they think a professor should dress, without any real interest or love. Their clothes are too tight or else a few years out of style and just add to the awkwardness of their bodies. After I was hired to teach for the first time, I bought a briefcase, and then after I started teaching, I carried it through the halls like the other professors. I could see that the older professors, mostly men, but also some women, were no longer aware of the importance of their briefcases, and that the younger women pretended they weren't aware of it at all. But the younger men carried their briefcases like trophies. At that same time, my father began sending me thick envelopes containing material he thought would help me in my classes, including exercises to assign and quotes to use. I didn't read more than a few pages sometimes when I was feeling strong. How could an old professor try to teach a young professor? Didn't he know I wouldn't be able to carry my briefcase through the halls and say hello to my colleagues and students and then go home and read the instructions of the old professor? In fact, I liked teaching because I liked telling other people what to do. In those days, it seemed clearer to me than it does now that if I did something a certain way, it had to be right for other people, too. I was so convinced of it that my students were convinced, too. Still, though I was a teacher outside, I was something else inside. Some of the old professors were also old professors inside, but inside, I wasn't even a young professor. I looked like a woman in glasses, but I had dreams of leading a very different kind of life. The life of a woman who would not wear glasses, the kind of woman I saw from a distance now and then in a bar. More important than the clothes the cowboy wore, and probably the way he wore them, was the fact that a cowboy wouldn't know much more than he had to. He would think about his work and about his family, if he had one, and about having a good time, and not much else. I was tired of so much thinking, which is what I did most in those days. I did other things, but I went on thinking while I did them. I might feel something, but I would think about what I was feeling at the same time. I even had to think about what I was thinking and wonder why I was thinking it. When I had the idea of marrying a cowboy, I imagined that maybe a cowboy would help me stop thinking so much. I also imagined, though I was probably wrong about this too, that a cowboy wouldn't be like anyone I knew, like an old communist or a member of a steering committee, a writer of letters to the newspaper, a faculty wife serving tea at a student tea, a professor reading proofs with a sharp pencil and asking everyone to be quiet. I thought that when my mind, always so busy, always going around in circles, always having an idea and then an idea about an idea, when my mind reached out to his mind, it would meet something quieter, that there would be more blanks, more open spaces, that some of what he had in mind might be the sky, clouds, hilltops, and then other concrete things like ropes, saddles, horsehair, the smell of horses and cattle, motor oil, calluses, grease, fences, gullies, dry stream beds, lame cows, stillborn calves, freak calves, veterinarians' visits, treatments, inoculations. I imagined this even though I knew that some of the things I liked that might be in his mind, like the saddle sores, the horsehair, and the horses themselves, weren't often a part of the life of a cowboy anymore. As for what I would do in my life with this cowboy, I sometimes imagined myself reading quietly in clean clothes in a nice study, but at other times I imagined myself oiling tack or cooking large quantities of plain food or helping out in the barn in the early morning while the cowboy had both arms inside a cow to turn a calf so it would present properly. Problems and chores like these would be clear, and I would be able to handle them in a clear way. I wouldn't stop reading and thinking, but I wouldn't know very many people who did a lot of that, so I would have more privacy in it because the cowboy, though so close to me all the time, wouldn't try to understand, but would leave me alone with it. It would not be an embarrassment anymore. I thought if I married a cowboy, I wouldn't have to leave the West. I liked the West for its difficulties. First, I liked the difficulty of telling when one season was over and another had begun. And then I liked the difficulty of finding any beauty in the landscape where I was. To begin with, I had gotten used to its own kind of ugliness, All those broad highways laid down in the valleys and the new constructions placed up on the bare hillsides. Then I began to find beauty in it and liked the bareness and the plain brown of the hills in the dry season and the way the folds and the hills, where some dampness tended to linger, would fill up with grasses and shrubs and other flowering plants. I liked the plainness of the ocean and the emptiness when I looked out over it. And then, especially since it had been so hard for me to find this beauty, I didn't want to leave it. I might have gotten the idea of marrying a cowboy from a movie. I saw one night in the springtime with a friend of mine who was also a professor, a handsome and intelligent man, kinder than I am, but even more awkward around people, forgetting even the names of old friends in his sudden attacks of shyness. He seemed to enjoy the movie, though I have no idea what was going through his mind. Maybe he was imagining a life with the woman in the movie who was so different from his thin, nervous, and beautiful wife. As we drove away from the movie theater on one of those broad highways with nothing ahead or behind but taillights and headlights and nothing on either side but darkness, all I wanted to do was go out into the middle of the desert, as far away as possible from everything I'd known all my life, from the university where I was teaching and the towns and the city near it, with all the intelligent people who lived and worked in them, writing down their ideas in notebooks and on computers in their offices and their studies at home and taking notes from difficult books. I wanted to leave all this and go out into the middle of the desert and run a motel by myself with a little boy and have a worn-out cowboy come along, a worn-out middle-aged cowboy, alcoholic if necessary, and marry him. I thought I knew of a little boy I could take with me. Then all I would need would be the aging cowboy and the motel. I would make it a good motel. I would look after it, and I would solve any problems sensibly and right away as they came along. I thought I could be a good, tough businesswoman just because I had seen this movie showing this good, tough businesswoman. This woman also had a loving heart and a capacity to understand another fallible human being. The fact is that if an alcoholic cowboy came into my life in any important way, I would probably criticize him to death for his drinking until he walked out on me. But at the time, I had that strange confidence born of watching a good movie that I could be something different from what I was, and I started listening to country western music on the car radio, though I knew it wasn't written for me. At that point, I met a man in one of my classes who seemed reasonably close to my idea of a cowboy, though now I can't tell exactly why I thought so. He wasn't really like a cowboy, or what I thought a cowboy might be like, so what I wanted must have been something else, and the idea of a cowboy just came up in my mind for the sake of convenience. The facts weren't right. He didn't work as a cowboy, but at some kind of job where he glued the bones of chimpanzees together. He played jazz trombone, and on the days when he had a lesson, he wore a dark suit to class and carried a black case. He just missed being good-looking, with his square, fleshy, pale face, his dark hair, mustache, dark eyes. Just missed being good-looking, not because of his rough cheeks, which were scarred from shrapnel, but because of a looser, wild look about him, his eyes wide open all the time, even when he smiled, and his body very still, only his eyes moving, watching everything, missing nothing. Wary, he was ready to defend himself, as though every conversation might also be something of a fight. One day, when a group of us were having a beer together after class, he was quiet, seemed very low, and finally said to us, without raising his eyes, that he thought he might be going to move in with his father and send his little girl back to her mother. He said he didn't think it was fair to keep her because sometimes he would just sit in a chair without speaking. She would try to talk to him, and he wouldn't be able to open his mouth. She would keep on trying, and he would sit there knowing he had to answer her, but unable to. His rudeness and wildness were comfortable to me at that point, and because he would tease me now and then, I thought he liked me enough so that I could ask him to go out to dinner with me. And finally I did, just to see what would happen. He seemed startled, then pleased to accept, sobered and flattered at this attention from his professor. The date didn't turn out to be something that would change the direction of my life, though that's not what I was expecting then, only what I thought about afterwards. He was very late coming to pick me up at the graduate student housing compound where I was staying, just when I had decided he wasn't coming after I had spent an hour pacing more and more hopelessly out onto my tiny tree-shaded balcony, which overlooked a playground in the parking lot, and back into my tiny living room, which was crowded with the things of some young couple I didn't know. He came in, wearing an old work shirt with the sleeves rolled up and brown corduroys with the cord worn off on the thighs. He stopped and looked around as though he were about to get to work on something. Then spotted the piano and bent over it for a moment and played a fast, pretty tune just long enough to make me happy again, then broke it off in the middle. I was very curious about him, as though everything that added itself to what I knew already would be a revelation. When we got into the car, he reached across me and unlocked the glove compartment, and when we prepared to get out, he reached across me and locked it again. I asked him why he did that, and he lifted up a bundle of papers in the glove compartment and showed me the wooden butt of a gun. He told me a couple of men were after him and that it had something to do with his little girl. We parked near the restaurant. He took a gray jacket off a hanger in the car and put it over his arm, and as we walked along, he tucked in his shirt and then put on the jacket. I thought to myself this was how a cowboy might do it, carry his gray suit in the car on a hanger, and when he neatened up to go into some place with a woman, he would also touch his hair gently. He drank milk with his Chinese dinner. He talked about his job, offering me pieces of scientific information, and then told some bad jokes. We didn't either of us eat very much, embarrassed, I think, to be alone together like this. He told me that he had married his wife right after he got back from the war. She was half Chinese and half Mexican. He told me his hearing had been damaged in the war, and I noticed that he watched my lips as I talked. He told me his balance had been affected too, and outside the restaurant I noticed how he would veer toward the curb when he walked. He drank milk in the restaurant, but beer in the bar where we went to play pool. He put his arm around me outside the bar, but back in the car he said he had to get home to his babysitter. Then he changed his mind and took me to a spot on a cliff that looked out over the ocean and kissed me. Other cars were parked around us and a pickup truck. He kissed me a number of times there in his old maroon Ford with the radio on so that I could have imagined I was a teenager again, except that when I was a teenager I had never done anything like that. Then we got out of the car and went to the edge of the cliff to look down at the ocean, the black water of the bay, and the strings of lights that reached out into the water from the town where we had been playing pool. We sat down on the sand not far from the edge of the cliff, and he told me a little more about how hard it had been with his wife, how he had tried to get back together with her, how he had done his best to charm her and she wouldn't be charmed. He told me he had been alone with his little girl for 6 months now, and his wife was coming home in a few days to try living with him again, even though nothing he did had ever worked. He said he wouldn't be able to see me again. I told him I wasn't expecting that anyway because I was leaving the West soon. It wasn't quite true that I hadn't expected to see him again, but it was true that I was leaving soon. Finally, he took me home and kissed me goodnight. As far as I could tell, I didn't mind the way the date turned out, though I started crying the next day in my car on my way to the drive-in bank. I thought I was crying for him, his fears, his difficulties, the mysterious men he thought were after him and his daughter. but I was probably crying for myself, out of disappointment, though exactly what I wanted, I'm not sure. Months later, after I was living in the East again, I called him long distance one night after having a couple of beers by myself in my apartment. And when he answered, there was noise in the background of people talking and laughing, either his family or a party, I can't remember which, and he sounded just as pleased to hear from me and flattered as he had sounded when I asked him out on the date. I still imagine marrying a cowboy, though less often, and the dream has changed a little. I'm so used to the companionship of my husband by now that if I were to marry a cowboy, I would want him to take him with me, though he would object strongly to any move in the direction of the West, which he dislikes. So if we went, it would not be as it was in a daydream a few years ago, with me cooking plain food or helping the cowboy with a difficult calf. It would end or begin with my husband and me standing awkwardly there in front of the ranch house, waiting while the cowboy prepared our rooms. That was The Professor by Lydia Davis. This is called Old Mother and the Grouch, also by Lydia Davis. From her 2009, The Collected Stories of Lydia Davis. Old Mother and the Grouch. "Meet the sourpuss," says the grouch to their friends. "Oh, shut up," says Old Mother. The grouch and Old Mother are playing Scrabble. The grouch makes a play. 10 points, he says. He is disgusted. He is angry because Old Mother is winning early in the game and because she has drawn all the yeses and blanks. He says it is easy to win if you get all the yeses and blanks. "I think you mark the backs," he says. She says a blank tile doesn't have a back. Now he is angry because she has made the word qua. He says qua is not English. He says they should both make good familiar words, like the words he has made, bonnet, realm, and weave, but instead she sits in her nasty corner making aw, e, fa, s, and ax. She says these are words, too. He says even if they are, there is something mean and petty about using them. Now the grouch is angry because Old Mother keeps freezing all the food he likes. He brings home a nice smoked ham and wants a couple of slices for lunch, but it is too late. She has already frozen it. "It's hot as a rock," he says, "and you don't have to freeze it anyway. It's already smoked." Then, since everything else he wants to eat is also frozen, he thinks he will at least have some of the chocolate ice cream he bought for her the day before. But it's gone. She has eaten it all. "Is that what you did last night?" he asks. "You stayed up late eating ice cream?" He is close to the truth, but are not entirely correct. Old Mother cooks dinner for friends of theirs. After the friends have gone home, she tells the grouch the meal was a failure. The salad dressing had too much salt in it, the chicken was overdone and tasteless, the cherries hard, etc. She expects him to contradict her, but instead he listens carefully and adds that the noodles also was somehow wrong. She says, "I'm not a very good cook." She expects him to assure her that she is, but instead he says, "You should be. Anybody can be a good cook." Old Mother sits dejected on a stool in the kitchen. "I just want to teach you something about the rice pot," says the grouch by way of introduction as he stands at the sink with his back to her. But she does not like this. She does not wish to be his student. One night, Old Mother cooks him a dish of polenta. He remarks that it has spread on the plate like a cow patty. He tasted and says that it tastes better than it looks. On another night, she makes him a brown rice casserole. The grouch says this does not look very good either. He covers it in salt and pepper, then eats some of it and says it also tastes better than it looks. Not much better, though. Since I met you, says the grouch, I have eaten more beans than I ever ate in my life. Potatoes and beans. Every night there is nothing but beans, potatoes, and rice. Old Mother knows this is not strictly true. What did you eat before you knew me, she asks. Nothing, says the grouch. I ate nothing. Old Mother likes all chicken parts, including the liver and heart, and the grouch likes the breasts only. Old Mother likes the skin on, and the grouch likes it off. Old Mother prefers vegetables and bland food. The grouch prefers meat and strong spices. Old Mother prefers to eat her food slowly and brings it hot to the table. The grouch prefers to eat quickly and burns his mouth. You don't cook the foods I like, the grouch tells her sometimes. You ought to like the foods I cook, she answers. Spoil me. Give me what I want, not what you think I should have, he tells her. That's an idea, thinks Old Mother. Old Mother wants direct answers from the grouch, but when she asks, are you hungry? He answers, it's 7 o'clock. And when she asks, are you tired? He answers, it's 10 o'clock. And when she insists and asks again, but are you tired? He says, I had a long day. Old Mother likes 2 blankets at night on a cold night, and the grouch is more comfortable with 3. Old Mother thinks the grouch should be comfortable with 2. The grouch, on the other hand, says, I think you like to be cold. Old Mother does not mind running out of supplies and often forgets to shop. The grouch likes to have more than they need of everything, especially toilet paper and coffee. On a stormy night, the grouch worries about his cat, shut outdoors by Old Mother. Worry about me, says Old Mother. Old Mother will not have the grouch's cat in the house at night because it wakes her up scratching at the bedroom door or yowling outside of it. If they let it into the bedroom, it rakes up the carpet. If she complains about the cat, he takes offense. He feels she is really complaining about him. Friends say they will come to visit, and then they do not come. Out of disappointment, the grouch and Old Mother lose their tempers and quarrel. On another day, friends say they will come to visit, and this time the grouch tells Old Mother he will not be home when they come. They are not friends of his. A phone call comes from a friend of hers he does not like. It's for you, Angel, he says, leaving the receiver on the kitchen counter. Old Mother and the grouch have quarreled over friends, the West Coast, the telephone, dinner, what time to go to bed, what time to get up, travel plans, her parents, his work, her work, and his cat, among other subjects. They have not quarreled so far over special sale items, acquisitions for the house, natural landscapes, wild animals, the town governing board, and the local library. A woman dressed all in red is jumping up and down in a tantrum. It is Old Mother, who cannot handle frustration. If Old Mother talks to a friend out of his earshot, the grouch thinks she must be saying unkind things about him. He is sometimes right, though by the time he appears, glowering in the doorway, she has gone on to other topics. One day in June, the grouch and Old Mother take all their potted plants out onto the deck for the summer. The next week, the grouch brings them all back in and sets them on the living room floor. Old Mother does not understand what he is doing and is prepared to object, but they have quarreled and are not speaking to each other, so she can only watch him in silence. The grouch is more interested in money than Old Mother, and more careful about how he spends it. He reads sale ads and will not buy anything unless it is marked down. You're not very good with money, he says. She would like to deny it, but she can't. She buys a book secondhand called How to Live Within Your Income. They spend a good deal of time one day drawing up a list of what each of them will do in their household. For instance, she will make their dinner, but he will make his own lunch. By the time they are finished, it is time for lunch, and old mother is hungry. The grouch has taken some care over a tuna fish salad for himself. Old mother says it looks good, and asks him if she can share it. Annoyed, he points out that now, contrary to the agreement, he has made their lunch. Old mother could only have wanted a man of the highest ideals, but now she finds she can't live up to them. The grouch could only have wanted the best sort of woman, but she is not the best sort of woman. Old mother thinks her temper may improve if she drinks more water. When her temper remains bad, she begins taking a daily walk and eating more fresh fruit. Old mother reads an article that says if one of you is in a bad mood, the other should stay out of her way and be as kind as possible until the bad mood passes. But when she proposes this to the grouch, he refuses to consider it. He does not trust her. She will claim to be in a bad mood when she is not, and then require him to be kind to her. Old mother decides she will dress up as a witch on Halloween, since she is often described as a witch by the grouch. She owns a pointed black hat, and now she buys more items to make up her costume. She thinks the grouch will be amused, but he asks her please to remove the rubber nose from the living room. The grouch is exasperated. Old mother has been criticizing him again. He says to her, if I change that, you'd only find something else to criticize. And if I change that, then something else would go wrong. The grouch is exasperated again. Again, old mother has been criticizing him. This time he says, you should have married a man who didn't drink or smoke, and who also had no hands or feet, or arms or legs. Old mother tells the grouch she feels ill. She thinks she may soon have to go into the bathroom and be sick. They have been quarreling, and so the grouch says nothing. He goes into the bathroom, however, and washes the toilet bowl. Then brings a small red towel and lays it on the foot of the bed where she is resting. Weeks later, old mother tells the grouch that one of the kindest things he ever did for her was to wash the toilet bowl before she was sick. She thinks he will be touched, but instead, he is insulted. Can't you agree with me about anything? Asks the grouch. Old mother has to admit, she almost always disagrees with him. Even if she agrees with most of what he is saying, there will be some small part of it she just disagrees with. When she does not agree with him, she suspects her own motives. She may agree with him only so that at some future time she will be able to remind him that she does sometimes agree with him. Old mother has her favorite armchair, and the grouch has his. Sometimes when the grouch is not at home, old mother sits in his chair, and then she also picks up what he's been reading and reads it herself. Old mother is dissatisfied with the way they spend their evenings together and imagines other activities, such as taking walks, writing letters, and seeing friends. She proposes these activities to the grouch, but the grouch becomes angry. He does not like her to organize anything in his life. Now the way they spend this particular evening is quarreling over what she has said. Both the grouch and old mother want to make love, but he wants to make love before the movie, whereas she wants to make love either during it or after. She agrees to before, but then if before, wants the radio on. He prefers the television and asks her to take her glasses off. She agrees to the television but prefers to lie with her back to it. Now he can't see it over her shoulder because she is lying on her side. She can't see it because she is facing him and her glasses are off. He asks her to move her shoulder. Old Mother hears the footsteps of the Grouch in the lower hall as he leaves the living room on his way to bed. She looks around the bedroom to see what will bother him. She removes her feet from his pillow, stands up from his side of the bed, turns off a few lights, takes her slippers out of his way into the room, and shuts a dresser drawer. But she knows she has forgotten something. What he complains about first is the wrinkled sheets, and then the noise of the white mice running in their cage in the next room. "Maybe I could help with that," says Old Mother sincerely as they are driving in the car. But after what she did the night before, she knows he will not want to think of her as a helpful person. The Grouch only snorts. Old Mother shares a small triumph with the Grouch, hoping he will congratulate her. He remarks that someday she will not bother to feel proud of that sort of thing. "I slept like a log," he says in the morning. "What about you?" "Well, most of the night was fine," she explains, "but toward morning she slept lightly, trying to keep still in a position that did not hurt her neck. She was trying to keep still so as not to bother him," she adds. Now he is angry. "How did you sleep?" she asks him as he comes downstairs late. "Not very well," he answers. "I was awake around 1:30, and you were still up." "No, I wasn't still up at 1:30, she says. 12:30, then. "You were very restless," says the Grouch in the morning. "You kept tossing and turning." "Don't accuse me," says Old Mother. "I'm not accusing you, I'm just stating the facts. You were very restless." "All right. The reason I was restless was that you were snoring." Now the Grouch is angry. "I don't snore." Old Mother is lying on the bathroom floor reading, her head on a small stack of towels and a pillow, a bath towel covering her, because she has not been able to sleep and doesn't want to disturb the Grouch. She falls asleep there on the bathroom floor, goes back to bed, wakes again, returns to the bathroom, and continues to read. Finally, the Grouch, having woken up because she was gone, comes to the door and offers her some earplugs. The Grouch wants to listen to Fischer Dieskau singing, accompanied by Brendel at the piano, but to his annoyance he finds that Fischer Dieskau, accompanied by Brendel, is also accompanied by Old Mother humming, and he asks her to stop. Old Mother makes an unpleasant remark about one of their lamps. The Grouch is sure Old Mother is insulting him. He tries to figure out what she is saying about him, but can't, and so remains silent. The Grouch is on his way out with heavy boxes in his arms when Old Mother thinks of something else she wants to say. "Hurry up, I'm holding these," says the Grouch. Old Mother does not like to hurry when she has something to say. "Put them down for a minute," she tells him. The Grouch does not like to be delayed or told what to do. "Just hurry up," he says. In the middle of an argument, the Grouch often looks at Old Mother in disbelief that is either real or feigned. "Wait a minute," he says. "Wait just a minute." Well into an argument, Old Mother often begins to cry in frustration. Though her frustration and her tears are genuine, she also hopes the Grouch will be moved to pity. The Grouch is never moved to pity, only further exasperated, and says, "Now you start sniveling." The grouch often arrives home asking such questions as, "What is this thing? Are you throwing coffee grounds under this bush? Did you mean to leave the car doors unlocked? Do you know why the garage door is open? What's all that water doing on the lawn? Is there a reason all the lights in the house are on? Why was the hose unscrewed?" Or he comes downstairs and asks, "Who broke this? Where are all the bath mats? Is your sewing machine working? When did this happen? Did you see the stain on the kitchen ceiling? Why is there a sponge on the piano?" Old Mother says, "Don't always criticize me." The grouch says, "I'm not criticizing you. I just want certain information." They often disagree about who is to blame. If he is hurt by her, it is possible that she was harsh in what she said, but it is also possible that her intentions were good and he was too sensitive in his reaction. For instance, the grouch may be unusually sensitive to the possibility that a woman is ordering him around, but this is hard to decide because Old Mother is a woman who tends to order people around. Old Mother is excited because she has a plan to improve her German. She tells the grouch she is going to listen to advanced German tapes while she is out driving in the car.
"That sounds depressing," says the grouch.
The grouch is cross about his own work when he comes home and therefore cross with her. He snaps at her.
"I can't do everything at once."
She is offended and becomes angry. She demands an apology, wanting him to be sincere and affectionate. He apologizes, but because he is still cross, he is not sincere and affectionate. She becomes angrier. Now he complains.
"When I'm upset, you get even more upset." "I'm going to put on some music," says the grouch.
Old Mother is immediately nervous. "Put on something easy," she says.
"I know that whatever I put on, you won't like it," he says.
"Just don't put on the Messiah," she says. "I'm too tired for the Messiah." The grouch comes into the living room to apologize for what he has said. Then he feels he must explain why he said it, though Old Mother already knows. But as he explains at some length, what he says makes him angry all over again, and he says one or two more things that provoke her, and they begin arguing again. Now and then, Old Mother wonders just why she and the grouch have such trouble getting along. Perhaps, given her failures of tact, she needed a man with more confidence. Certainly, at the same time, given his extreme sensitivity, he needed a gentler woman. They receive many Chinese fortunes. The grouch finds it correct that her mentality is, quote, "alert, practical, and analytical," unquote. Especially concerning his faults. He finds it correct that, quote, "the great fault in women is to desire to be like men," unquote. But it has not been true so far, most of the time anyway, that, quote, "someone you care about seeks reconciliation," unquote, or that, quote, "she always gets what she wants through her charm and personality," unquote. Certainly the grouch wanted a strong-willed woman, but not one quite as strong-willed as Old Mother. The grouch puts on some music. Old Mother starts crying. It is a Haydn piano sonata. He thought she would like it, but when he put it on and smiled at her, she started crying. Now they are having an argument about Charpentier and Lully. He says he no longer plays Charpentier motets when she is at home because he knows she does not like them. She She says he still plays Lully. He says it's the Charpentier motets she doesn't like. She says it's the whole period she doesn't like. Now she has put her stamps in his stamp box, thinking to be helpful. But the stamps are of many different denominations and have stuck together in the damp weather. They argue about the stamps and then go on to argue about the argument. She wants to prove he was unfair to her since her intentions were good. He wants to prove she was not really thinking of him. But because they cannot agree on the sequence in which certain remarks were made, neither one can convince the other. The grouch needs attention. But old mother pays attention mainly to herself. She needs attention too, of course, and the grouch would be happy to pay attention to her if the circumstances were different. He will not pay her much attention if she pays him almost none at all. Old mother is in the bathroom for an inordinately long time. When she comes out, the grouch asks her if she is upset with him. This time, however, she was only picking raspberry seeds out of her teeth. That was Old Mother and the Grouch by Lydia Davis. I have a few more minutes, so I'm going to read some other very short stories by Lydia Davis. This one is called Interesting. My friend is interesting, but he is not in his apartment. Their conversation appears interesting, but they are speaking a language I do not understand. They are both reputed to be interesting people, and so I'm sure their conversation is interesting, but they are speaking a language I understand only a little, so I catch only fragments such as I see, and on Sunday, and unfortunately. This man has a good understanding of his subject and says many things about it that are probably interesting in themselves, but I am not interested because the subject does not interest me. Here is a woman I know coming up to me. She is very excited, but she is not an interesting woman. What excites her will not be interesting. It will simply not be interesting. At a party, a highly nervous man, talking fast, says many smart things about subjects that do not particularly interest me, such as the restoration of historic houses, and in particular the age of wallpaper. Yet because he is so smart, and because he gives me so much information per minute, I do not get tired of listening to him. Here is a very handsome English traffic engineer. The fact that he is so handsome and so animated and has such a fine English accent makes it appear, each time he begins to speak, that he is about to say something interesting, but he is never interesting, and he is saying something yet again about traffic patterns. This is called The Old Dictionary. I have an old dictionary, about 120 years old, that I need to use for a particular piece of work I'm doing this year. Its pages are brownish in the margins and brittle and very large. I risk tearing them when I turn them. When I open the dictionary, I also risk tearing the spine, which is already split more than halfway up. I have to decide each time I think of consulting it whether it is worth damaging the book further in order to look up a particular word. Since I need to use it for this work, I know I will damage it, if not today, then tomorrow, and that but by the time I am done with this work, it will be in poorer condition than it was when I started, if not completely ruined. When I took it off the shelf today, though, I realized that I treat it with a good deal more care than I treat my young son. Each time I handle it, I take the greatest care not to harm it. My primary concern is not to harm it. What struck me today was that even though my son should be more important to me than my old dictionary, I can't say that each time I deal with my son, my primary concern is not to harm him. My primary concern is almost something else, almost always. For instance, to find out what his homework is, or to get supper on the table, or to finish a phone conversation. If he gets harmed in the process, that doesn't seem to matter to me as much as getting the thing done, whatever it is. Why don't I treat my son at least as well as the old dictionary? Maybe it is because the dictionary is so obviously fragile. When a corner of a page snaps off, it is unmistakable. My son does not look fragile, bending over a game or manhandling the dog. Certainly his body is strong and flexible and is not easily harmed by me. I have bruised his body and then it has healed. Sometimes it is obvious to me when I have hurt his feelings, but it is harder to see how badly they have been hurt and they seem to mend. It is hard to see if they mend completely or are forever slightly damaged. When the dictionary is hurt, it can't be mended. Maybe I treat the dictionary better because it makes no demands on me and doesn't fight back. Maybe I am kinder to things that don't seem to react to me. But in fact, my houseplants do not seem to react much, and yet I don't treat them very well. The plants make one or two demands. Their demand for light has already been satisfied by where I put them. Their second demand is for water. I water them, but not regularly. Some of them don't grow very well because of that, and some of them die. Most of them are strange-looking rather than nice-looking. Some of them were nice-looking when I bought them, but are strange-looking now because I haven't taken very good care of them. Most of them are in pots that are the same ugly plastic pots they came in. I don't actually like them very much. Is there any other reason to like a houseplant if it is not nice looking? Am I kinder to something that is nice looking? But I could treat a plant well even if I didn't like its looks. I should be able to treat my son well when he is not looking good and even when he is not acting very nice. I treat the dog better than the plants, even though he is more active and more demanding. It is simple to give him food and water. I take him for walks, though not often enough. I have also sometimes slapped his nose, though the vet told me never to hit him anywhere near the head, or maybe he said anywhere at all. I am only sure I am not neglecting a dog when he is asleep. Maybe I am kinder to things that are not alive. Or rather, if they are not alive, there is no question of kindness. It does not hurt them if I don't pay attention to them, and that is a great relief. It is such a relief, it is even a pleasure. The only change they show is that they gather dust. The dust won't really hurt them. I can even get someone else to dust them. My son gets dirty and I can't clean him, and I can't pay someone to clean him. It is hard to keep him clean and even complicated trying to feed him. He doesn't sleep enough, partly because I try so hard to get him to sleep. The plants need two things, or maybe three. The dog needs five or six things. It is very clear how many things I am giving him and how many I am not, therefore how well I am taking care of him. My son needs many other things besides what he needs for his physical care, and these things multiply or change constantly. They can change right in the middle of a sentence, though I often know, I do not always know just what he means. Even when I know, I am not always able to give it to him. Many times each day I do not give him what he needs. Some of what I do for the old dictionary, though not all, I could do for my son. For instance, I could handle it slowly, deliberately, gently. I consider its age. I treat it with respect. I stop and think before I use it. I know its limitations. I do not encourage it to go farther than it can go. For instance, to lie open, flat on the table. I leave it alone a good deal of the time. That was The Old Dictionary by Lydia Davis. This is another very short one called How Difficult. For years, my mother said I was selfish, careless, irresponsible, etc. She was often annoyed. If I argued, she held her hands over her ears. She did what she could to change me, but for years I did not change. Or if I changed, I could not be sure I had, because a moment never came when my mother said, "You're no longer selfish, careless, irresponsible, etc." Now I'm the one who says to myself, "Why can't you think of others first? Why don't you pay attention to what you're doing? Why don't you remember what has to be done?" I am annoyed. I sympathize with my mother. How difficult I am. But I can't say this to her, because at the same time that I want to say it, I am also here on the phone, coming between us, listening and prepared to defend myself. Okay, I think I got about 1 or 2 more minutes before the radio stream cuts me off. So here's a really short one called "The Murder in Bohemia" by Lydia Davis. In the city of Friedland in Bohemia, where all the people are anyway, pale as ghosts and dressed in dark winter clothes, an old woman was unable any longer to bear the inevitable falling of her life into destitution and disgrace, and went mad and murdered, out of pity, her husband, her 2 sons, and her daughter, out of anger, her neighbors on one side and her neighbors across the street, who had scorned her family. Out of revenge, the grocer